Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
You are in the Mill Creek Cottonwood Room, and the paper we're going to hear today is, Can the Resurrected Christ Be God? Must God Be Incorporeal? We have two distinguished people to be with us today, and I'd like to introduce them to you. David Paulson will present his paper. He received his law degree from the University of Chicago and his PhD from the University of Michigan. He's currently a professor at BYU in the philosophy department. He deals in religious philosophy primarily. He's the author of several articles, and he has a book forthcoming on Mormon theology. Okay. He will be followed. The comments will be by Reverend Francis Mannion. We're pleased to have him with us today. He is the rector of the Cathedral of the Madeleine in Salt Lake City, a director for theological affairs at the Catholic Diocese in Salt Lake. He's the chair of the Ecumenical Commission of the Catholic Diocese. He received his doctoral at the Catholic University of America, and he's published many articles as well. He has two essays that will appear in forthcoming books. We'll have David Paulson present his paper, immediately followed by comments from Reverend Mannion, and then we will have time to take questions from you as well.
I have a handout that I've distributed, just in case you didn't get one. Blake Oscar's helping out there. My paper does consist of a number of arguments that will be evaluated, and I know how difficult it is to follow an argument when it's only orally presented, so I hope this handout will be of assistance. Further, I read my paper this morning. It took me about 40 minutes, and I'm advised that I have about 30 for my presentation, so I'm going to have to move rather rapidly and watch the time.
Although I'm sure there is some residual.
Thinkers within the Western theistic tradition have for centuries reasoned that God logically must be incorporeal, without body or parts. Yet Christian theists commonly affirm that God the Son was incarnate in the person of Jesus of Nazareth, was crucified and raised from the dead, and now exists everlastingly with a resurrected, though gloriously transformed, body. These views apparently conflict. For if God must be incorporeal, then the resurrected Christ cannot be God. The problem can be expressed in the terms of an inconsistent triad. And by an inconsistent triad, I simply mean a set of three premises, the affirmation of two of which entail the negation of the third. So the first proposition, Jesus of Nazareth exists everlastingly with a resurrected body. Jesus of Nazareth is God, and it is necessary that if X is God, then X is incorporeal. In this paper, I examine the most common rational arguments for proposition three. I conclude that none of them is sufficient to prove it, and hence that none ought be a stumbling block to rational acceptance of the resurrected Christ as God. The pattern of reasoning that these three arguments typically follow, as well as two particular arguments, were set out by St. Anselm in the 11th century. Anselm defined God as that than which none greater can be conceived. And from this general description of God, he deduces not only that God exists by means of his famous ontological argument, but he also attempts to deduce what God must be like. In particular, he argues that X is the greatest conceivable being logically entails that X is incorporeal. It will be helpful to outline his position in some detail. In defining the formula, greatest conceivable being, Anselm makes it clear that by conceivable, he does not mean psychologically imaginable. Otherwise, God's greatness would not exceed the limits of human thought, and certainly God's greatness must surpass our ability to comprehend. Thus, by greatest conceivable being, he apparently means that than which no greater is logically possible. As to what he means by greatest, Anselm explains that the greatest conceivable being would lack nothing that is good, and would be whatever it is better to be than not to be. Contemporary commentators have plausibly suggested that in this context, the value terms, greatest, good, better, are best understood as signifying religious values. On this view, when Anselm refers to the greatest conceivable being, he means that than which a no more worthy of worship is logically possible. The formula is often shortened to the most worthy object of religious worship, or the most adequate object of our religious attitudes. I will take these shortened formulae to be equivalent to those stated by Anselm. This bit of analysis provides the backdrop for six separate arguments for divine incorporality, which I now examine. First of all, the argument from divine infinity. From the formula, X is the greatest conceivable being, Anselm first derives the conclusion that X cannot be limited in any way. J.N. Finley, a modern commentator, suggests the following rationale. Quote, he says, it is wholly anomalous to worship anything limited in any thinkable manner. For all limited superiorities are tainted with an obvious relativity and can be dwarfed in thought by still mightier superiorities, in which process of being dwarfed they lose their claim upon our worshipful attitudes. And hence we are led on irresistibly to demand that our religious objects should tower infinitely above all other objects. From the inference that God cannot be limited in any way, Anselm concludes that God cannot be or have a body. He argues, quote, but everything that is in any way bounded by place is less than that which no law of place limits. Since then, nothing is greater than thou, no place contains thee, but thou art everywhere. Or again, for altogether circumscribed is that which, when it is wholly in one place, cannot be at the same time in another. And this is seen to be true of corporeal things alone. But uncircumscribed is that which is, as a whole, at the same time everywhere. And this is understood to be true of thee alone. Anselm's argument can be summarized as follows. And if you look at your handout, you find argument A stated, the argument from divine infinity. God, then, is defined as the most worthy object of religious worship. Second premise, the most worthy object of religious worship cannot be limited in any way. Three, if God were corporeal, then he would be limited. He could not be, as a whole, at the same time, everywhere. Hence, God cannot be corporeal. As a first, admittedly ad hominem objection to premise two, it is instructive to note that if it is understood literally, it seems as if St. Anselm himself cannot consistently affirm it. For if God were absolutely unlimited, he would have to be the whole of reality. And indeed, Finley, in his book, begins his book with a little aphorism, how odd of God to choose the Hindus. That is, it seems as if the claim that God must be absolutely unlimited entails the claim that God must be identical with the whole of reality. So there could be nothing external to God that could serve as a limit or a condition on him. But of course, this is not the God whose existence St. Anselm purports to establish. Rather, he purports to establish the existence of the Creator God of theistic theology, who is ontologically distinct from his creatures, and who gives his creatures some measure of independence over against himself. Similarly, if God were not limited in any way, God could not possess any determinate attributes, either positive or negative. For example, if God were absolutely unlimited, then if he were immutable, he would be limited in that he could not be mutable. And if he were timeless, he would be limited in that he could not be temporal. Indeed, Finley suggests that absolutely unlimited being may well entail a deific absence of anything definite. But Anselm employs his deity formula to generate some 18 divine attributes. So when I say that this is an ad hominem argument, it's an argument against the person making the argument, that is, against St. Anselm. It seems as if it proves too much, that is, it seems as if it proves conclusions that St. Anselm himself would reject. Ad hominem objections aside, Finley's assertion that it's absolutely anomalous to worship a being limited in any thinkable manner seems to mistakenly imply that a limitation, as a limitation, is itself a defect. But surely this depends rather on the nature of the limitation. Obviously, a limitation in something that is not admirable, for example, a limitation in ignorance, selfishness, or cruelty, would be a good thing. Anselm makes it clear that the greatest possible being would be absolutely limited only in every admirable or great-making attribute. But even here, we have long recognized that it's possible to have too much of a good thing. A virtue taken to excess may become a tragic flaw. One may be too trusting, too generous, too helpful. Limitations, qua limitations, are value neutral. Moreover, as Charles Hartshorne has taught us, not all values, especially when we consider them raised to their superlative instance, are logically compossible. For example, it seems as if a being could not at the same time be unlimitedly compassionate and unlimitedly blissful. Nor do all great-making properties or perfections admit of completion or of a ceiling. For example, Hartshorne argues that creativity is a great-making attribute which surely is characteristic of deity. And yet, no matter how much God has created, or perhaps more importantly, no matter how many different kinds of things God has created, he can still create not only something more, but something novel. And so it seems as if we cannot coherently understand the notion of divine perfection in terms of the completion of all great-making attributes. No doubt what Anselm meant, or perhaps should have meant, then, is not that the most worthy object of religious worship must be unlimited in every respect, but rather the most worthy object of religious worship must be unlimited in every respect, in which to be so is, one, possible, two, admirable, and three, when conjoined with other excellences, worship worthy maximizing. I use this term WWM to represent worship worthy maximizing. But if we replace premise 2 in St. Anselm's argument with 2 prime, the argument is no longer valid. In order to make St. Anselm's argument work now, we will have to supply some additional premises. More specifically, we will need to show that there is some particular respect in which God must be absolutely unlimited, that is both possible and worship-worthy maximizing, and at the same time incompatible with his being corporeal. Perhaps we may think that unlimited power would satisfy these conditions. That is, perhaps we may think that Proposition 5 is true, and Proposition 5 is on your handout. It is both possible and worship-worthy maximizing to be absolutely unlimited in power. Using 5, we can reconstruct St. Anselm's argument as argument B here, the argument from divine omnipotence. God, again, is understood as the most worthy object of religious worship. 2 prime says the most worthy object of religious worship must be absolutely unlimited in every respect in which it's both possible and worship-worthy maximizing to be so. It is both possible and worship-worthy maximizing to be absolutely unlimited in power. But necessarily, if God is corporeal, then he's not absolutely unlimited in power, and hence God cannot be corporeal. We must now consider whether this argument is sound, and we'll turn our sights, first of all, on premise 5. Is premise 5 true? And the first question we must ask is it possible for God to have absolutely unlimited power? Here the answer is clearly negative. Indeed, the logical paradoxes generated by the notion of absolutely unlimited power are too well known to merit rehearsal. Now, I apologize because I may not be too well known to this audience. I wrote this article for the community of thinkers in my discipline. But if you want some more information about this, I'd be happy to elaborate on it later. To salvage a rationally coherent view of God, thinkers have been compelled to opt for definitions of omnipotence considerably more restricted than its etymology would suggest. Recently, for example, Kenny has proposed that omnipotence be understood not as the power to do everything or the power to do everything that is logically possible, but rather the possession of all logically possible powers, which is logically possible for a being with the attributes of God to possess. Notice how complicated the definition becomes in order to salvage a coherent notion of omnipotence, where attributes refers to properties of God that are not themselves powers. Given Kenny's proposal, how do we determine which attributes God possesses? If this is to be determined by revelation, and if revelation confirms that God the Son is embodied, then omnipotence must be understood in terms of the logically possible powers which is logically possible for an embodied being to have. So understood, there would be no conflict between divine power and divine embodiment. If, on the other hand, we must ascertain all of the divine attributes by reasoning from St. Anselm's formula, we must ask, how much power must the most worthy object of religious worship possess? And two, could an embodied being coherently possess that much power? In considering the first question, it seems evident that from a religious point of view, the matter of God's power relates to our practical needs for individual help, protection, and preservation. We look to God for forgiveness of our sins and for power to repent, for strength to cope with and be refined by our adversities, for comfort in our trials, and above all, for salvation and eternal life. We trust that God's power is sufficient to satisfy these needs and expectations and to fulfill all his purposes and promises. For this to be assured, it seems as if God must be supreme and have power over all things, so that no one or no thing can thwart the fulfillment of his will. Let us use the term almighty to refer to the power described. And just a parenthetical note here. In English, we have two terms that are commonly used to describe divine power. The one is omnipotence, and the other is almighty, or almightiness. Omnipotence is by and large a product of rational theologizing. It's understood as the power to do all things. Well, almighty, I believe, is the scriptural notion of divine power, which doesn't mean the power to do everything, but rather power over all things, supremacy, the power to bring about all of his purposes and promises. If we grant, and it seems we must, at least from the perspective of the ordinary believer, that in order for to be the most worthy object of religious worship, that it's necessary that God be almighty, must we also grant that such power is sufficient? It seems so. God's worship worthiness connects most essentially with his personal and moral attributes, his holiness, his loving kindness, compassion, long-suffering, justice, veracity, as they are faithfully and steadfastly expressed in his personal dealings and relations with us as Father, Creator, Savior, Exemplar, and Friend. His power, too, is relevant, but only to the extent that it's needful to accomplish those ends which he as a perfectly loving and righteous Father freely chooses. To suppose otherwise is to affirm that there is something worship-worthy about power per se, quite apart from the good ends that it makes possible. That some may, in fact, value or even worship power for its own sake, I don't doubt. But this is neither religiously nor morally required. If my reasoning is correct, then it is neither possible nor worship-worthy maximizing for God to be absolutely unlimited in power. And thus, Proposition 5 of Argument B is false. But our analysis also supplies the following more satisfactory alternative to 5, and I call this 5 prime. Again, it's on the handout. The most worthy object of religious worship must be almighty. To make St. Anselm's argument work, we must also replace premise 6 with premise 8, which is on your handout. That is, that it's necessarily true that if X is corporeal, then X is not almighty. But now we can ask the question, is premise 8 true? If it is, it is by no means self-evident. Some further premises must be supplied to show why a corporeal being cannot be almighty. St. Anselm's argument suggests a possible connecting link. That is, his argument suggests that if God is almighty, he must be omnipresent. And if he were omnipresent, he could not be corporeal. With these claims, we can again reconstruct Anselm's argument. And now we get the argument from divine omnipresence. It's argument C on your handout. I won't state it. It's there. To properly evaluate this argument, we must understand more clearly what is meant by the claim that God must be omnipresent. Anselm suggests that if God is omnipresent, then he is present as a whole, at the same time, everywhere. This notion is less puzzling when we consider it in its religious setting. Perhaps the idea is nowhere better captured than in the hymn of the psalmist. Quote, Lord, thou hast examined me and knowest me. Thou knowest all, whether I sit down or rise up. Where can I escape from thy spirit? Where can I flee from thy presence? If I climb up to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, again I find thee. If I take my flight to the frontiers of the morning or dwell at the limits of the western sea, even there thy hand will meet me and thy right hand will hold me fast. Religiously, the affirmation of God's omnipresence is the assurance of God's loving awareness of all that is transpiring, his constant watchful care, and his ability to intervene in human history and in our individual lives to fulfill his purposes and promises. Thus it seems that divine omnipresence is crucially related to his power and knowledge, and that if he is almighty, then he must be omnipresent. This brings us to a consideration of premise 10. Is it true that an embodied being could not be omnipresent? This question has recently been carefully examined by Grace Stike. She correctly points out that the claim that an embodied being cannot be omnipresent is ambiguous between his body cannot be everywhere, which she says is true but harmless, and he cannot be everywhere, which she argues is not necessarily true. The harmless truth follows analytically from the meaning of the word body. By definition, a body is spatially locatable and can only be in one place at one time. But if a being is omnipresent, then there is no place where it is not. Thus, it appears that the notions of omnipresence and corporality are logically exclusive. Dyke rebuts this conclusion by means of a careful analysis of the meaning of the relevant sense of presence and then derivatively of omnipresence. Most critical to her analysis, she shows that, one, it's not the case that I am present only in the volume of space occupied by my body. And two, to be present at X means, most essentially, to be aware of what is going on at X and perhaps to be able to some extent to influence it. In support of one, we would surely say of a speaker addressing the Senate that he is present in the Senate chambers, even though it is not the case that the spatial coordinates of his body are coextensive with those of the chambers. And as to two, how would a senator who slowly falls asleep as a bill is read and remains so throughout the ensuing debate correctly answer the question, were you present when the measure was considered? Or suppose a hearing on a bill to eliminate veterans' benefits is held in a hospital ward of comatose veterans. Could they correctly be said to be present for the hearing? On her analysis, Dyke concludes that if God has a body which is spatially locatable somewhere in the universe, and if from that position he knows and is able to influence everything that is going on, then he could properly be said to be omnipresent. If this is correct, then premise 10 is false, and the argument from omnipresence fails. But one may still feel constrained to ask, how would it be causally possible for God to be spatially located in the universe and yet be aware of and able to influence all that is going on? Here I have to frankly admit I don't know. But I don't know how he could be omnipresent in any other sense either, in that sense of omnipresence. This, I take it, is a question for the theologian. But perhaps two brief suggestions would not be out of order. First, Dyke points out that modern mathematicians have shown that three-dimensional geometry is not the only possible geometry. indicating that it's merely a limitation of our conceptual structure, which is a contingent conceptual structure, that we perceive only three spatial dimensions. Dyke thus conjectures that God may occupy or be localized in dimensions outside our ordinary experience, from which he may express his there-ness in every part of the universe as we perceive it. Second, the glorified body may be the source and locus from which emanates the divine spiritual influence everywhere immanent in the world. And this idea is an idea that has been long familiar to Latter-day Saint missionaries. They often use the simple analogy of a heavenly body like the sun, arguing that even though the sun, as a body, has a spatial location, the light waves and energy that emanate from the sun proceed to fill the immensity of space. Let's move on to the argument from divine indestructibility. Anselm suggested this argument when he wrote, "For whatever is composed of parts is not altogether one, but is in some part plural and diverse from itself, and either in fact or in concept is capable of dissolution. But these things are alien to thee, thou than whom nothing better can be conceived of." The following seems to capture his reasoning, and you have handout on your handout, look at argument D. The idea is that anything that is made up of parts, anything that is composite, is thereby susceptible to decomposition. Therefore, if there is anything that is not subject to decomposition or destruction, it must be absolutely simple or without parts. That's the core idea. Well, now, is this argument sound? Well, let's look at premise 12. Considering premise 12, it seems evident that the most worthy object of religious worship cannot be destructible in fact. Saint Anselm is surely right. And let us, on that point, let us grant arguendo that a corporeal being would of necessity in some sense be composite. What about premise 14? Is it true that whatever is composite is thereby destructible in fact? In Plato's Phaedo, it is noted that natural or physical bodies are composite and are often observed to be destroyed through a process of decomposition. From this, it is concluded that all bodies, being composite, are likewise destructible. This, of course, does not deductively follow. At best, what we have here is an inductive argument. And even if we grant that all natural bodies are liable, even if we grant that all natural bodies are liable to decomposition, it doesn't follow that a spiritual body is. Finally, even if a spiritual body were not inherently indestructible, it would not follow that God could not everlastingly sustain it in being. In sum, I find no conceptual incoherency in the notion of Christ's body being raised incorruptible, or in the notion of an incorruptible body per se. But what about St. Anselm's worry that a body, even if it is not destructible in fact, would nonetheless be destructible in concept? What if we can just barely, if we can merely imagine that Christ with a resurrected body being composite was subject to decomposition? Would that be sufficient to make the notion that he is divine incoherent? Are all bodies destructible in concept? I suppose this depends upon our concept of a body, and particularly upon our concept of a material body. If we think of a body as merely a composition of little bits, tiny bits of matter, then it seems as if we can imagine its being decomposed. On the other hand, if we think of a body, especially a spiritual or a resurrected body, in terms of a field of force, the idea of its being decomposed is not so readily grasped. But even if we granted that the destruction of any body is consistently thinkable, what difference would it make? Only grounded in the integrity of the divine character and will, and not in the mesh of conceptual necessity. Thus it seems that divine indestructibility does not require incorporeality. Finally, the argument from divine self-existence. H.P. Owen, in his recent book, Concepts of Deity, provides two more arguments. He claims that corporality is logically incompatible with both divine self-existence and divine moral perfection. His argument from divine self-existence is very tersely stated. Quote, God's incorporeality can also be proved from his self-existence. No material entity can be self-existent, for each is a determination or mode of being. Consequently, we can always ask of any such entity, what are its causes and conditions? But of course, we cannot intelligibly ask of a self-existent being, what are its causes and conditions? Because presumably a self-existent being has no causes or conditions. The following seems to capture his reasoning, and it's argument E on your handout. Premises 17 and 18 seem open to doubt, or at least in need of clarification. Concerning 17, and 17 is the claim that necessarily if something is self-existent, then it cannot be a determination or mode of being. Concerning 17, Owen has not explained what he means by a determination or mode of being. But apparently he means something like a species or a category or a classification of being. As contrasted with what? Totally undifferentiated being or being itself? If so, it seems that 17 proves too much. And again, this is an ad hominem objection. For personality, as well as corporality, appears to be a mode or a determination of being. Not all being is personal. And so if it follows that a self-existent being cannot be a mode or determination of being, then if personality is such a mode, and if God is a personal being, then God cannot be self-existent by his argument.
Perhaps one reason the LDS tradition.
But I see no basis for such a claim. Owen apparently provides the following argument for premise 17, and again you have that on your handout. And I've stated this already. You can just look at it quickly. Premise 2 of his supportive argument for premise 17 appears to be analytically true. That is the claim that we can't intelligibly ask of a self-existent being what are its causes and conditions seems to follow. By definition. And 3 apparently follows from 1 and 2. But 1 seems questionable. What can be intelligibly asked is a function of the syntax and semantics of our language. For example, the reason why we cannot intelligibly ask about the causes and conditions of a self-existent being is that self-existence simply means without cause or condition. Premise 1 does not appear to be analytically true. If I understand determination or mode of being correctly, it does not grammatically imply must or could have a cause. Whether some particular mode or determination of being is caused or uncaused is dependent on the nature of reality, on the way things are, not on the meaning or structure of our language. Thus, it seems that this support for premise 17 falls, and so the premise remains inconclusive. That is, he's failed to establish that 17 is true. And thus, the argument from self-existence thus fails to prove that God must be incorporeal. Owen's final argument for divine incorporeality is based on the claim that pure spirit is the most perfect form of being. He says, quote, moreover, if a dualistic view of mind and matter is correct, we can see not only that God's pure spirituality is possible, but also that it is the most perfect form of being. All human behavior approaches perfection to the extent that it expresses wisdom, goodness, and love. Yet although the body aids these spiritual properties insofar as it offers a medium for their expression, it also inhibits them in many and some tragically frustrating ways. Hence, only pure spirit can constitute an absolutely perfect form of personal existence. And by pure spirit, he means that which is totally non-physical or without body, immaterial. And his argument is summarized as argument F on the handout. Owen acknowledges that the cogency of his argument depends on the Cartesian view that mind and matter are ontologically distinct, a view that he does not attempt to justify. But Owen admits that unless it can be validated, we have no basis for affirming pure spirituality in God, since we could not give the concept any reference range. It is significant to note that most contemporary defenses of the doctrine of divine incorporeality do not consist of positive arguments for it, but rather of attempts to salvage the notion of a totally unembodied person from charges that it is either cognitively meaningless or logically incoherent or contraindicated by the weight of psychological, physiological, and other evidence. I will not rehearse the arguments and evidence here. Suffice it to say that the Cartesian anthropology on which this argument rests does not appear to be rationally coercive. I'm not saying that this Cartesian anthropology is false. I'm simply saying that it isn't rationally coercive. One is not rationally compelled to accept it. Assuming arguendo that there could be a totally unembodied mind, why should we consider this to be the most perfect form of personal existence? Owen suggests that human behavior approaches perfection to the extent that it expresses wisdom, goodness, and love, and that the body inhibits these spiritual properties in many and some tragically frustrating ways. Unfortunately, Owen does not explain just how the body acts or constitutes such an inhibiting agency. Personally, I find the idea hard to grasp. Certainly, the body is not an independent agency that might override decisions or choices made by the mind. Might it then somehow be the source of all those desires or wants that may incline or tempt one to choose contrary to that which is wise, good, or loving? But to assign all these to the body and nothing but honorific attributes to the mind seems entirely gratuitous and without ground in reason or experience. Ironically, and again this is an ad hominem argument, in Orthodox Christian theology, the most maliciously evil person, Satan, is also supposedly an unembodied mind or pure spirit. It seems to me much more reasonable to predicate all attributes, praiseworthy and blameworthy, to the person and not to disparate parts of the same. But suppose we grant that a body is a causally necessary condition of our feeling certain desires or inclinations, such as the desire for food or sexual gratification. Assuming that such desires and inclinations are not intrinsically evil, would they nonetheless necessarily inhibit a person from always choosing rightly? I don't see why. The New Testament describes the mortal Jesus as one who is tempted in all points, such as we are, but without sin. It might well be wondered whether one who has fully confronted temptation in all its guises and conquered it is not more worthy of admiration and worship than one who has never experienced a conflict. It seems then that premise 21 is false, and for all the reasons given, this argument too fails to demonstrate that God must be incorporeal. In sum, then, it appears that none of the common arguments, at least the common arguments that I've reviewed in this paper, that try to prove that God cannot be embodied, is sufficient to prove it. And thus, none of these arguments ought to be a stumbling block to rational acceptance of the resurrected Christ as God.
I want to say what a pleasure it was to read and to listen again to Dr. Paulson's very reasonable and logical analysis. We live in a time when many people, including many religious people, are skeptical of rationality in religious discourse. Today, a good deal of religious discourse is emotionally based and subjective in its foundations. Clearly, Dr. Paulson cannot be accused of that kind of bias. Now to the nitpicking part. which is the fun part. I want to say, of course, at the outset that I am not taking on Dr. Paulson in a personal way. I think his argument is very logical and coherent and probably very well expresses some fundamental structures of LDS thought. Therefore, it seems to me that the fundamental issue here is an issue between what he describes as the Orthodox Christian view and the LDS view of the questions at hand. I must admit, however, to being a little unnerved by Dr. Paulson's opening paragraph. He asserts at the outset that Christian theists commonly affirm that God the Son was incarnate in the person of Jesus of Nazareth and now exists everlastingly with a resurrected, though gloriously transformed, body. But, he says, if God must be incorporeal, then the resurrected Christ cannot be God. Having listened to Dr. Paulson's analysis of this traditional Christian assertion, my general reaction is that he is not adequately sensitive to the highly complex nature of theological assertions, nor is he adequately attentive to the highly coded nature of theological language. I am tipped off to that by the fact that when he says Christian theists commonly affirm that God the Son was incarnate, he places the words "the Son" in brackets, as though the Son is merely a qualification of God. But the fact that it was God the Son, or God's Word, that became incarnate, and not God the Father, or the fount of Godhead, is crucial to the traditional Christian view. There are profound implications in that way of stating the matter for avoiding the problem that occurs for Dr. Paulson. Again, he says that Jesus now exists everlastingly with a resurrected, though gloriously transformed, body. Again, "though gloriously transformed" here appears as a qualification of the concept resurrection. However, in the view of historic Christian theology, resurrection means a gloriously transformed body. Any view of resurrection that does not include gloriously transformed body would lead automatically to the kind of problem about God's corporeality that confronts Dr. Paulson. The fact is, the phrase "resurrected body" belongs to a quite different level of discourse than do the words "incorporeal" or "corporeal" and the word "body." The word "corporeal" or "incorporeal" and the word "body" are words with an empirical base. The word "resurrection" belongs to the level of religious language and has, therefore, a very different basis for verification. The fact is, in the most authentic tradition of theology in historic Christianity, the word "resurrection" overcomes all dualities and oppositions regarding the relationship between corporeal and incorporeal, physical and spiritual. It cannot, therefore, be invoked in discussion about corporeality without a recognition that it belongs to an order of discourse different from ordinary language, from which source comes words like "body" and "corporeality." What is at issue, it seems to me, here essentially, is the matter of the analogical nature of religious language. Once we open our mouths about God, we are in the realm of analogy. That is a principle of fundamental importance to the theological tradition. It is something that we can never remind ourselves about enough. It is something which theologians themselves often forget, and it is something that needs to be the subject of constant reminders today. Unless one realizes the analogical nature of religious language and of phrases like "resurrected body," one will move back and forth between analogical language and ordinary language in a manner that will create false distinctions, false deductions, false logic, and ultimately false theology. The kind of theology written by St. Anselm too easily itself takes on this false character. And those who critique it often do so without appreciating the philosophical language problem involved in Anselm. Indeed, it seems to me many people are often attracted to people like Anselm precisely because they share the same weaknesses about language and about the coherence of theological logic that he does. Both proponents and opponents, therefore, easily involve themselves in logical and propositional card games, and the discourse inevitably breaks down. Something that must also be kept in mind, it seems to me, in dealing with St. Anselm and the early scholastic theologians is the context and purpose of the theological construction. That makes an enormous difference. Anselm, after all, was a Benedictine monk who was a firm believer in the Christian tradition, including the tradition of God's incorporeality. What Anselm sought to do was to show that faith was reasonable. Faith for Anselm, however, did not depend on reason. For him, faith had its own internal logic. But once one confessed the truth in faith, one then passed over into reason to amplify and articulate that faith in a reasonable way. Anselm, as the first of the scholastics, did a magnificent job, but not a perfect one. He was later overshadowed by people like Thomas Aquinas, who did a much better and much more logically coherent job in constructing a rational theology. My point is this: the theology of God's incorporeality does not stand or fall on the arguments of Anselm. Others have written on the subject and done a much better job. Indeed, Anselm himself did not depend on his own arguments, but returned in faith to the overwhelming thrust of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which affirmed the incorporeality of God. What Anselm gives us, then, is in a certain way a sophisticated version of party talk about God's bodiliness. His schematization is a useful exercise, but must be taken with a grain of salt. What he was doing was pioneering the possibility of testing what faith looks like when one moves out into rational discourse. And he found that it worked rather well in his case, but in any case he moved back into the realm of faith, the logic of which was much more important for him. Perhaps then Dr. Paulson accords Anselm's arguments too much importance and too easily gives the impression that the deconstruction of Anselm's scheme in effect deconstructs the belief of historical Christianity on the questions at hand. Dr. Paulson concludes his paper by saying, "None of the common arguments for divine incorporeality considered here in this paper is sufficient to prove it, and thus none ought to be a stumbling block to rational acceptance of the resurrected Christ as God. It is true that none of the arguments for divine incorporeality he considers are sufficient to prove it, but that does not mean that there is not a much more compelling set of arguments available in the theological tradition. We also have to be aware of the complex nature of what constitutes proof in theological matters. Indeed, modern theology is rightly very skeptical of the value of proof at all. Theology seeks to name, to articulate, and to reveal. When it goes beyond that into proofs, it begins to betray its own better intentions." Finally, the implication in Dr. Paulson's paper that the notion of divine incorporeality is a stumbling block to rational acceptance of the resurrected Christ as God puzzles me. In the LDS tradition, there is certainly a problem here, but in the logic of the longer Judeo-Christian tradition, there is no such problem at all. And this leads me back to my fundamental concern, the need for greater attention to the analogical nature of theological language. Such attention would, I believe, lead an LDS theologian to appreciation of the much greater complexity of theological logic than is first apparent. Such attention would accordingly lead to a greater appreciation of the magisterial quality of the way that traditional Christianity argues the very difficult subject of God and his relation to the person of Christ, not least in the matter of God's bodiliness and its relation to the incarnation of the Word in Jesus of Nazareth. Thank you.